so that they could have their own private Hebrew school. They were instructed, these boys were instructed by the son of Stephen Weissman, who was one of the founding rabbis with the Jewish Theological Seminary. You know, he was very instrumental in the Zionist politics.
Well, that's a very heavily Talmudic tradition.
Yes, it is.
So we're talking Zoharist, we're talking the Talmud, and of course you the listeners are well aware what that implies. So what we're looking at also, Jennifer, is, you know, you take a look at people like Morgenthau and Baruch and the rest of them, and but they also go back to financial interests as well, do they not?
Oh yes, they most certainly do. You know, these were families that had made large intermarriages. The Strauss family intermarried with the Lehman family, the Sachs family. You know, they functioned like a monarchistic dynasty, and this is how they did it. And, you know, take that as a perfect example, looking back over time, how royal families were intermarried with each other, and this is how they kept their hegemony. The same thing was done here with Zionists. They functioned in exactly the same way. In fact, who knows that they didn't originate this pattern in the Dark Ages, you know, that this was pretty much the basis of how this control was developed, and that as far as European history goes, and henceforth the Western history in general, that they set up these patterns back in those days. So back to Charlemagne and then, you know, come on forward. You see how this is done. So this is a repetition of these dynastic patterns, and it was done through these families. And they arranged for private education. John D. Rockefeller Jr. did not go to public school. He went to a private school that was set up by his family. I think they called it the Little Brown School, and kind of the Freemasonic wing had entrees there through their prep schools, and you know, they kept these personal relationships going through educating their children, through having clubs and organizations, and they didn't need to have any professional associations because they had such a well-defined private association going. And this goes on.
Well, this is above the workaday people. This is above the guys that they recruit into to do their bidding for them. These are the real controllers level. This is the people who actually sit back in their ivory towers and decide for the rest of us what sickness we're all going to fall victim to, or what financial malaise we're all going to become withered by. I mean, the truth is, these are not the people who walk in the limelight. They walk in the shadows.
Yes, well, they put themselves above shadows, even. You know, they're not phantoms. They certainly did very public and very well-known things in their day. It's just that it's so overwhelming to us from a historical perspective to have to go back and root that stuff out and dig it out. There's a lot of there, and it can be found. That's the evidence. That's why it takes so long for researchers to play catch-up.
Yep.
And we're all busily playing catch-up. We really need to use our intuition, I think, at this point in time to root out the most essential of things. And to me, you know, I look at, you know, you sort of have taken the financial picture into your domain, and that's what you look at. And I'm just coming in from a medical perspective, and I'm looking at disease and how this disease model has just pervaded the entire globe.
Well, they've also built their billions in fortunes of finding cures for the diseases they're creating in many ways. I mean, look, we've got a compromised immune system from the system they put in place, and then of course when we fall ill, it is the very system that they caused that they're profiting from.
Right, and it you know, done through complication, basically. You just keep complicating these issues, and we're complicating people's chemistry. One of the things that I feel, you know, most most deeply is that we've altered the chemistry of the planet, and there, it's an impossibility to say that this doesn't alter us, because chemistry is the foundation of life. So when you bring this up through time and add to that flare weapons, the spread of radiation, you know, we're getting more and more complicated types of chemistries into the environment, then we're obviously going to have lots of life forms developing out of this chemistry. This is what I call the, it's a new primordial soup. And it's just, it's a foregone conclusion that it's going to change the nature of life.
Well, systems never sit in stasis, Jennifer. They're always evolving, and it doesn't matter if they're evolving from negative inputs or from positive ones. They're evolving nonetheless. And what you're saying is that all of these toxic environments are devastating for human beings in our previous state. Now, what we're coming into now is a state where we are almost tied at the joined at the hip to this medical system we're creating. Because the diseases coming out of our modern world are actually they're self-fulfilling. They're building them and then they're curing them, but they're not curing them really. They're only staving them off for a period.
Right. They're just think of all of it as chronic illness.
Yes.
What it's doing is that it's just perpetuating more diverse kinds of chronic illness.
Well, aren't we all victims of some kind of chronic illness? I mean, think about it. There's nary a person you can't meet today who's not ill from some sort of debilitating or terrible condition of one or another type. I mean, you know, if you meet somebody with West Nile today, tomorrow is somebody else with, you know, with some other sickness. They've got Lyme disease, or they've got Epstein-Barr, or, a herpes outbreak, or, I mean, we can go on and on. All of them debilitating, all painful, all of them coming on the heels of a depressed immune system, if I'm guessing correctly.
Yeah, that certainly plays its part, having a depressed immune system. But... you know, trying to find a key, looking at things that are infectious, that actually damage the neurological structure of humans.
Mm-hmm.
And these diseases are neurological in their function. This is how they work. They destroy your nerves. Your nerves, of course, this is the enlivening activity of your whole body. Looking at polio syndrome, what they call post-polio, seeing this as a chronic illness, also knowing that I can't even give you numbers, the numbers are so high, how many people have been injected with polio virus. We sort of take this as a template for infectious agents of all kinds, then neurological damage is the end result. And the immune system is challenged by, mostly I would think, poor nutrition. We have the knowledge, certainly now, that we should be able to have some agreement on what makes good nutrition. And in fact, I don't think we do. I think people are very confused about how to eat, what's good, what the evolutionary pattern. And without this, we have a system that tries to equate everything as equals. We know things are not equal. We know that there's not an equality in having fresh milk, for example, than having pasteurized milk. These are not equal.
Well, it's not equal, Jennifer, to get a vegetable grown on a factory farm where the soil has been depleted of all minerals, and all you've got is a colorful object in front of you that's almost devoid of quality. So you're not getting the vitamins and the nutrition that you think you're getting. What you in fact are getting is almost a piece of plastic.
That's pretty close.
Yeah.
You're just getting something else. You're getting, a plant that's been grown from a seed. But there again, now where do the seeds come from? Are these genetically modified fruits and vegetables? There aren't enough standards in place now to find protection there. And certainly there's a you know, a vocal contingent that's demanding that for, you know, disclosure be given to people so that they can make choices, that they can choose not to have genetically modified food.
Well, we supposedly, you know, we supposedly have that right in Europe here, but they're actually ignoring it left, right, and center. They're not supposed to be growing genetically modified corns here in France, but they're allowing thousands of experimental hectares to be grown. So the fact is that if you're growing regular corn, the pollens from those diseased corns are getting in your corn, and you're ending up with garbage. You're ending up with sickened plants. You know, they've got rust viruses and funguses coming down out of the sky, and it's just astonishing what I'm watching these people do by the chemical and biological process. And yet, the leadership of this world, who we know are criminals, are well aware of this, in my view. Have you seen links to the present-day controllers and what's happening to us now?
Well, you know, they're very veiled under the banner of their institutional and I think we are at the point now where we really just have to look at entire institutions as being faulty.
Mm.
And get beyond the idea that we can bring individuals to account. We've historically brought the individuals to account, so we know who they are. So going back that far, at least, and moving things forward, we start looking at the politics. Who pushed it? How did this get to be an organization? What kind of jurisdiction does it have? Politicians, on the other hand, are people we can definitely look to, and because we've designated them as our leadership. So we should really be bringing them to account. Know that through compartmentalization, that unfounded kinds of principles become foundational, and they're just wrong. Know that.
Yep.
This is the protocol's program. It's how it works, and people learn things wrong. Then you end up having people of goodwill who are promoting something that is not in the interest of the population of the world.
Well, they were very successful in the 70s of recruiting people, and they've continued that success through today. You'll find people working throughout Africa, Jennifer, thinking they're doing their good, you know, do-gooders, working for the World Health Organization, inflicting vaccines on the poor, and they think that they're helping out. And of course, when you take a look behind the World Health Organization or the Organisation Mondiale de Santé, OSM, you find out that these people are actually sickening the public, sickening the populations of the world, and then when disease outbreaks happen later on, they use the fact that they were there inoculating as justification for what's happening. They say, see, we're right. We were right to be there. But in fact, it was them that was weakening the group.
Right.
It's interesting. Let me give that a little go over again, Jen. They'll arrive in a community. This happened in Mozambique. I have a pretty interesting bit of data that came through on Mozambique, and they came and they inoculated everybody after a bad storm period, hurricane period, and they gave everybody these inoculations. And, well, sometime after, there were outbreaks of all types of diseases, including, hemorrhagic-type fevers. There was AIDS outbreaks, all kinds of stuff. And what we found out was that their immune systems had been destroyed by inoculation. And many of these Africans are saying, we don't want your vaccines. They're running from these people. Am I correct?
Well, that's what's happening, yeah. Just empirically, people are aware that this is a consequential series of events.
Every time these people arrive, you get sick after. So that means.
So who wouldn't want to run?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you look at Western nations, that they've actually have laws in place that forbid you to run. You're not allowed to make the choice not to have that treatment. So this is where. This is where we really have to, kind of buckle down with the science and discredit the science. And that's not hard to do. That we have the time. We've had a century of this kind of treatment. So we have the time to look at and find real facts. Information is not always available, but that's kind of not to the point. There is certainly enough information available that we can make these determinations true.
Well, in your discussions with Dr. Banks, she's one of only very few doctors out there, but she's beginning to find the full program and is not different than what you're discovering, and there are other doctors out there, but who are the bad guys in our current world today pushing these sicknesses forward? I know that the Gates Foundation has been instrumental in delivering the sicknesses around the world. Who's feeding them these sicknesses? Is there a group that can be identified here?
What do you mean exactly by feeding them the sicknesses?
Well, I mean, he's putting up $2 billion to go into Africa with inoculations, and then lo and behold, they find a RBH in them, which is a sterilizing agent when they test the vaccine in India.
Talking about the manufacturers of the vaccine.
Well, I don't know if it's manufacturers or it's the government itself, or is it both, or are they working together? I mean, and what are their names? Who are these people? What are they doing? Yeah.
Well, you know, they are the traditional pharmaceutical houses that we are all familiar with.
Merck and Lilly and GlaxoSmithKline and.
Right. That it's them. It's that establishment. This has been a flowering aspect of the fascism within our state, and so we have public-private partnerships to look at, where this is a perfect example. You know, the Gates Foundation is a private foundation, and it's partnering with governments, so it's making these public-private kinds of agreements to go ahead and spread this stuff all around the world. But we should be very clear to understand that a vaccine is a bioweapon. A vaccine is a load of chemicals. Now, life forms do arise from chemical bases. If we understand that from our studies of the origins of life, and if a vaccine has the potential to introduce a chemical template into your system, then through natural processes of mutation and things like that, any number of organisms, virus, develop and become infectious to that person. So we're just creating chaos out of our chemistry. So that's simple. A vaccine is a weapon. Anyone who's promoting that then is guilty and responsible.
I agree, and of course it's one of the main pillars of their future assault on us. And in fact, I see an infrastructure being built worldwide for this avian flu, this H5N1, and now they're saying H7N5, H5N13, I mean, you're giving it every kind of LMNOP nomenclature you can think of. The fact is, Jennifer, is that it's all going to come back to giving everybody a shot for this stuff, and I'm betting my last 50 cents that everybody who gets that shot somehow is going to come down with some form of this bird flu.
Well, you know, it doesn't have to be the book's definition of what bird flu is going to be, whatever they kind of decide the symptoms of that illness are. When you inject someone with an agent that can cause infection, it has neurological effects. So you're simply inoculating people with illness. That's the bottom line, that this kind of situation is ripe for any kind of continuing infectious illness to develop. So a vaccine is the injection of a chronic illness. Now, if you don't get ill from a vaccine, you can very likely become ill later in life. And you will. I mean, statistically, we already have this model. We see it with polio, and this is why I focused my research on that, is that any number of things. When I first started looking at polio, I saw a list, a long, long list of all kinds of other diseases. Now, when I look at Spanish flu, and that's the H1N1 flu, that's what they've designated as the first flu. Very possible that there was no such thing as an influenza virus prior to this event. You know, the books now, the message that's going out is that they're trying to recreate this virus. They're trying to, you know, find 1918 flu victims and determine what they died from, what kind of infectious agent. Well, there was no infectious agent that, you know, had something you could slap a label on. They really had to create this. And, you know, it's kind of coming full circle. In the 1970s, it's politically useful.
Swine flu comes to mind.
Right, exactly. Well, there you are. So Spanish flu, at that time, was then said to have come from swine. It was swine flu. So in the 1970s, it was expedient to say, well, we have to look at the biggest flu epidemic there ever was and say, well, that was swine flu. So that message has also been promoted in books that are current now that have come out since 1999. But what's also come out, and there are plenty of articles about it, I'm still documenting them so that I can write about them, is that they're saying, no, it wasn't swine flu, it was bird flu. So now the expedient is say the Spanish flu was bird flu. This can be twisted and turned in any way that's useful at the time. So,
not very different, Jennifer, than the tactic they're using for global warming, when in fact, for the last 7 years, the world's global temperature has been dropping. And anybody who comes up, any scientist, any climatologist that stands up and says, wait a minute here, the data says that the worldwide temperature is dropping and sunspot activity is dropping and things are getting colder, they go, you're a charlatan, crazy quack, and you're going to lose your job. Take away his funding, fire him. And then the guy's got no job, no money, no nothing, and you never hear another word from him. And they go on telling you the world is getting hotter when everyone can see around them. They're having blizzards and snowstorms in October in London for the first time in 75 years.
Yeah. Well, this is how it works.
This is the media-controlled criminal gang pushing their orthodoxy upon the rest of us, and in the end, we're all going to lose, and we are losing. And when you see people like Nathan de Rothschild behind global warming, and you see people if you look into the medical establishment and look behind Monsanto and look behind all these drug companies, Merck and Lilly and the rest, you find the same criminals. Oh, we're in a mess, Jen. We're in a mess. What can we do? Let's go, because we're coming to the end of the hour here, and this is thought-provoking stuff. What can people do in a real-world sense? What can they do immediately to improve their health? I've often pushed the idea that growing your own garden vegetables is going to provide you with a vitamin-rich product. It may not be blemish-free, but don't worry about the blemish. They're supposed to be there. But what you're getting is good food, and by going to the store and getting these perfect pieces of fruit and vegetables, you may in fact be getting something that's not very healthy in the first instance. Am I correct?
Yes, I think you're very correct there. And there's something about when you're growing your own food, you're also not processing that food.
That's right.
And even what's fresh and sits on grocery store shelves has been washed, rinsed, who knows what else has happened to it. So anything that's really outside of your active participation is questionable.
Mm-hmm.
So the more you can provide for yourself in as direct a fashion as you can, the better off you're going to be. Now, what I think is been a fairly successful propaganda campaign over time is that we're supposed to kill microbes. Well, you know, according to the Origin of Life studies that I've been doing, we are, our composition, our physical bodies are 90% microbes. And this being true, and what I said earlier about having a healthy intestine, having all the bacteria and fungi that belong in your intestine there, that this is how we balance the microbial world for ourselves. So it's important for us to ingest certain kinds of bacteria and fungi. That's essential.
Like acidophilus, like natural milks, like natural unpasteurized cheeses, how about the vitamin content coming from natural cabbage that has been sitting in the ground for 6 months, where you get a nice sauerkraut that has all kinds of wonderful bacteria and flavors and acids that help you stabilize your base levels. And
so you want to do as little, you want to commit germicide as little as possible when it comes to your food. We are living in a changing environment. The chemistry is changing. We have to face that. We have to deal with that. And that our food is going to be one of the best ways to mediate this changing environment for us. Now, there's a caveat here. And this is where we have to go beyond the discussion of vaccines, the kind that are administered, you know, by health professionals. When you genetically modify fruits and vegetables and things, they're being genetically modified not just to improve their color and their texture and their shelf life, but they're actually being modified to produce vaccines. So we are there. We're already there. There are lots more kinds of fruits than just tomatoes that make very good vaccine carriers. So we have to have this awareness as try to kind of reconnect to our food sources as being literal vehicles of inoculation for us.
So you're recommending heavily to people to get heirloom seeds and grow their own.
Yeah, I think that's essential.
Yeah.
And there again, this has all been thought out ahead of time for us. And there are companies that specialize in heirloom seeds. Well, how do we know the difference? We don't, do we? We don't know. We're just going on the good faith and will of distributors that this is accurate. This is being accurately disseminated to us. That we're getting what they're telling us. Now, we know in the United States, because we're constantly doing battle with labeling laws. This is an essential part of information sharing. And there's so much criminal activity potential here. There's so many loopholes in this system that people just don't know what they're actually getting. So we have to bear that in mind. And, you know, bear in mind always at this point that we are part of this natural world, that we have to accept that things are changing. I think that if we do the least amount of physical harm to the very bacteria that give us support as symbionts living in harmony with nature, that this will kind of negotiate for us this change.
Well, one of the other things I'd like to recommend to people, when you buy foods in the supermarket, fresh foods, aside from not knowing whether they're going to be very helpful or any, they need to be washed repeatedly, because the types of chemicals used as insecticides are oil-based, and oil-based insecticides, by their nature, do not get washed off easily with water. They're designed to stay on those plants in the event of rain. So the fact is, you just rinsing them under the faucet once is not going to do a good job. And there are trace amounts of that pesticide in all of these foods coming across your table. And of course, one exposure to that's not going to kill you. But if that's the exposure you're getting on a daily basis for years and years, you're destroying your health and your immune system.
Well, yep, you're right. So we've got a huge dilemma because of this kind of situation here, and so many people are only able to buy foods that have been pesticided, and that's all they have access to.
Well, I recommend, Jennifer, if they can, using natural, and there are available natural soaps. I have a place here that makes a beautiful olive oil soap that's completely natural, little artisan here. I put a little soap in my palm and I wash off my vegetables that come from the store and I thoroughly rinse. And I know that a soap will break through that oil and remove it. And the soap that I'm cleaning it with is not chemically altered because I know the person that made it, fortunately for me. But my point is that I have actually gone as far as thinking about these kinds of things in my own life. I've taken it upon myself to be proactive in how I'm going to reduce the harm I'm doing to my immune system here.
Right. Well, you know, and there are other strategies as well. Something that cancer patients learn is that it's good to have a little extra body fat. And one reason for that is because if you're ingesting lots of toxins on a regular basis, your body has to contend with this at all times. Now, chances are, in a toxic environment, your body's not going to be able to keep up very well, and it's going to seek to store toxins in fat tissue until it can get rid of it, if it can get rid of it. But what happens here, if you don't have a little extra body fat on you, that toxins then go to other fatty places in the body, and they'll go to the fatty organ. One of the largest we have is the brain. So it goes to the brain, it goes to the liver, and it goes to fatty glands in place of fat. So a good detox regimen should be part of everybody's dietary plan. And we need to learn about that. But in the meantime, it's also a good idea to have a little bit of extra body fat on you, and that helps prevent toxins from entering your brain and your liver and your lymph nodes, and just, you know, go from there. There's a lot to it, Daryl. There's strategy. There are other kinds of nutrients and things that we can take. Chlorella is something that is identified as being able to chelate metals and take metals out of the system. So, you know, and I at this point in my life, really turned away from things that are processed. Avoid as much as you possibly can anything that's processed.
Well, you know, I'm going to give everybody, Jen, I've been off processed food for a long time, and when I eat some just by accident, I can taste the chemicals right away because I've desensitized. I've become desensitized to the stuff, and now I'm very sensitive to it. I can taste it immediately. It's shocking how much chemical taste you can find in processed food.
Mm-hmm.
You don't notice it when you've got it all over you.
You're right. And that's another part of this dilemma. So just in general, we need to de-chemicalize our lives. Stop using products and things like that are chemically based. And
clean your house with a mixture of vinegar and hydrogen peroxide in a bottle. It's a perfect a cleaner for tops of counters and kitchens, and yet carries no residual sickness along with it. It's not based in any poisonous chemical.
Right, but you know, the best thing that you can do is really understand the fundamentals of your own nutrition and work with that, because this is what's going to most bolster you to be able to resist these things. So you want to make this a real parallel plan to learn about what good nutrition is, especially to question what's going on in your intestinal tract. You know, I've cared for a lot of elders who have had digestive failure be part of their degenerative process. And I think it's really a key thing. And there are a lot of naturopaths and alternative practitioners who say, you know, the toxicity that builds up in the intestinal tract is the primary cause of degeneration for most people. And what the epidemiologists are telling us is that there are over 70 different kinds of microbes that are fatally toxic to us that live in our intestines, polio being one of them. Or more than one. Polio is actually a whole range of microbes of different sorts. So protecting the digestive tract then doesn't permit a lot of this stuff to come in, to enter the bloodstream and then henceforth enter the brain. cause inflammation and disease there, because brain infection can be something that has no symptoms whatsoever, that it bears out much later in life as degenerative illness of some kind.
Well, Jen, we've gone over our hour, actually, by about 10 minutes. It goes fast, doesn't it? It really does. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to bring Jennifer back from time to time, as I already have. And it was a good way of setting the stage for her next articles, because you get a little background information. Plus, if you read the articles we've got on the website, you'll get more information. And there's more coming. This is an ongoing story. It is not divorced from the financial story, because it's the same principles involved, and it's the benefit going to these same criminals and same principles. So bear that in mind as you learn about this stuff, and then become proactive, I would say, in taking care of your own health. Look into some of the claims we're making about bolstering your intestines and other things, and try to get chemicals out of your environment. And these are just some basic good ideas that you can use in your daily lives, and some ideas that you can use in your research. Is there anything you'd like to add, Jennifer, before we go here?
Well, Darrell, I look forward to getting back on the air with you again sometime and talking about this more. I do intend to write about this, because I not only want to expose where this is coming from and who's promoting this and how it's done, but what that alternative path has also got to offer, and how we can reframe all of this and get ourselves back on track. I think we have great possibilities of doing that, and that's really the emphasis that I'm putting into this now.
Well, again, thanks for your spending the time here on this Sunday, Jennifer. It's appreciated by me, and I'm sure the listeners. Ladies and gentlemen, take care of your families, huh? Inform them. Reteach them how to live again. We've lost a lot of our good ideas from the past. Many of them were time-tested. They've been destroyed over the last few generations, and they need to be brought back into practice, many of them. And take care of yourselves. And until the next time, this is Darrell Bradford Smith telling you all, please, be well. Bye-bye now.